Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Diana E. Hess. Hess has a PhD from the University of Washington in Seattle. She is currently a professor of curriculum and instruction at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And she is also the senior vice president of the Spencer Foundation, a private foundation that invests in education research. She has written two books on education, including her most recent and the one we'll be talking about in this interview. It's called The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. It was co-written by Paula McAvoy and published by Routledge in January of this year. I'm speaking to Diana Hess by phone from her office in Chicago. Diana Hess, thank you so much for joining me. Let's begin with the philosophy that education should not just be to prepare children for doing well on tests or getting jobs, but for preparing them to be really engaged citizens in a democracy. Well, let's talk about that.
The traditional reason we have public schools to begin with in the United States is to prepare young people to participate politically. So in the political classroom, what Paula McAvoy and I concentrate on is how to do that in practice. And one of the things that we learned from the research that the book is based on is that there are a lot of teachers out there who understand this to be one of the key roles of public schools, this being preparation for political and civic engagement.
Mm-hmm. And then so the study of this book is mainly how teachers navigate discussion, and especially about controversial political issues.
Correct. We started this study in 2005, and we were in high school classes in three states. And what we were interested in learning about was what happens in classes where teachers are engaging their students in discussions of these highly controversial political issues. And by a political issue, what we mean is a policy issue. So these would be the issues that we need to work through as a society about what we should do about some problem. So, for example, in the last 2 weeks, we've had, you know, all this discussion about the measles vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a really interesting policy issue there about what should public policy be related to requiring parents to have their children vaccinated. And, you know, that's a policy that's been worked out differently in different states. But it's clearly a live policy given what we see happening now. And that would be, you know, a really great example. Whether or not the Keystone Pipeline should be built is another example on the national level. And certainly there's all sorts of examples in local communities, in states, and even in schools themselves. You know, they have to make policy decisions about what to do about certain things. So that's what we mean by a controversial political issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you went into different schools in Indiana, Wisconsin, and Illinois between 2005 and 2009, correct?
Correct.
And you went into liberal schools and conservative Christian schools and mixed schools. So talk to us a little bit about the flavors that you came upon.
Right. So we were interested in making sure that we covered the waterfront of schools. And so we're in some urban charter schools, we're in traditional public schools, in all sorts of different kinds of communities. We were in private schools, and some of those private schools were religious and some were not. And another difference among them was the political community in which they were housed. So some of these schools were in cities and towns that are very, very progressive. Others are in cities and towns that are very, very conservative. And then some are in what we call purple communities, where you have more of a mix of ideologies. And what we were interested in is what relationship is there between the dominant ideologies in the community and what we see in the schools. And we found, I think not surprisingly, that in conservative communities, the students tend to be more conservative, and in progressive communities, the students tend to be more progressive, which doesn't mean that they are completely mirroring the political views of their parents,
mm-hmm.
but it does mean that they're being influenced by the political community in which they're growing up. And that can cause some real challenges, because if you're trying to teach young people how to deliberate public policy issues across difference, and you've got a very politically homogenous class, that's actually a problem. Because in order to teach people how to deal with multiple and competing views, you need to have multiple and competing views. So in the classes where those were not naturally occurring as much, teachers need to go through a lot of things in order to get that inserted, whether it's doing it through materials or bringing in guest speakers or whatever.
Or they themselves would play devil's advocate often when there was only one view being addressed, right?
Absolutely. You know, that was another really common strategy we saw. And, what we think that represents is this need that teachers have to make sure that students are not just marinating in their kind of ideological silo, that they really are being exposed to differing points of view. Now, of course, in some communities, that's really easy because all those differing points of view are naturally occurring.
You know, I think it's pretty interesting that you did this study in between 2005, 2009, as we said, and it has become so polarized in this country during this study. Weren't you surprised that you were doing this during a time when it was so polarized in our government?
Well, we were surprised at how polarized it was becoming. I mean, clearly, we've had political polarization, you know, for quite some time. And, you know, there's some level of political polarization that's actually healthy for democracy. We want there to be difference. You know, if you think back 40 and 50 years ago, political scientists worried about the fact that the two major parties were too similar to one another. Well, that's clearly not a worry that we have anymore. But, you know, we were really paying a lot of attention to what was happening with political polarization and also what was happening with income inequality, because that has a pretty dramatic influence on how teachers go about teaching students to prepare for political and civic participation. And one of the things that did surprise us is both political polarization and income inequality were growing quite dramatically. And we really saw that playing out both in the classes, and then when we followed these young people 2 and 4 years out after high school, we were interested in what influence would those phenomena have on what young people were doing as citizens. And what we found was that the young people who were raised in these like-minded communities were much more likely to participate politically than those who were raised in more mixed communities. And that's a real conundrum in American politics, because that's not unique to young people. We know that's the case with older people as well, that the more polarized you are, the more likely you are to participate. And that creates some real problems, because if what we have is the people participating who are really polarized, it's not going to provide very many opportunities to have meaningful solutions across differing points of view.
Yeah. It's like people who choose teams. They feel like they're part of a team, and they go, rah, rah, my team. The other guys, we got to get them. You know, I mean, it's the same thing we're seeing in national politics. Now, I know you've done a lot of these studies, and you wrote a book before this one. Do you think that the internet has helped facilitate polarization, or has it helped? How have you written that into these studies, the fact that the internet is so prevalent?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we collected a lot of data on how young people were using social media and how they were using the internet for both information gathering and also for political communication. But the study wasn't predominantly about that. But what we did notice is that the sources of information that young people are drawing on are very different, obviously, than they would have been 30 years ago. And they're different for adults as well. And there's like good news and bad news. You know, the good news is you can find information so much easier today than you could 20 years ago or 30 years ago. I mean, it's really phenomenal when you think about the amount of information and high quality information that we're able to access instantly.
But I also worry about the misinformation that's out there that, you know, that young kids don't necessarily know how to navigate.
I worry about that too, because, you know, if you think about political information coming from places that were vetted previously, like you were, you know, getting political information from a newspaper that had fact checkers and had editors and had, you know, a whole system set up to make sure that you didn't have just blatant misinformation, which is not to say that that's not the case with sometimes. But, you know, now we're in a land of unvetted information. And as you suggest, that means we have to teach young people how to do something that we didn't have to focus on as much in the past. So there's a big movement kind of called news literacy or media literacy that's, I think, a very important part of civic education, you know, which is just this, to help young people understand, you know, what they need to do to interrogate the information that they're being exposed to, which, quite frankly, is very difficult.
It is for adults, too.
Fallen for things that, you know, have come through our Facebook pages or through email or whatever that, you know, have been turned out to be blatantly false, but for which we think initially that they're true.
And I say it so often with The Onion, you know, that satirical newspaper. I've met so many adults who find those stories, they think they're real and they aren't, just like a kid would. Now, you mentioned in this book that people are not born with democratic dispositions and schools are indispensable in helping, you know, create citizens who engage in democracy and engage in deliberation. To talk to us a little bit about that, what else did you find in regard to that?
Well, schools are indispensable for three primary reasons. The first thing is that's where the students are. So if we're interested in preparing all people to participate politically and civically, then we've got to do that in the places where we have lots and lots of young people, and that is school, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's not that people don't learn how to participate politically in other venues as well. I mean, people, you know, learn a lot from their faith communities, and they might learn a lot from an after-school activity, mm-hmm. from a club that they're in. But as a matter of empirical fact, there are more young people in schools than in those other communities. And so that's why schools need to focus on this, because that's how we're going to make sure that we attend to equality. And by equality, I mean we need to make sure that all young people are getting a good shot at high-quality civic education. So that's one reason. A second reason is because this is what schools traditionally were developed to do, in part. And, you know, for good reason, that developing politically has a lot to do with skills, and it has a lot to do with dispositions, but also has a lot to do with building knowledge and conceptual knowledge. And a lot of that knowledge is very, very difficult. It's probably not going to be built as well in an after-school program that doesn't have an academic orientation as it would in schools. I mean, imagine, for example, that you wanted to make sure that people had a really good, robust understanding of due process, let's say, or what equal protection means. Well, teachers can teach that, and if they're powerful teachers, they can teach it in a really engaging way. And so we need to make sure that those kinds of understandings get built. And the other thing is that even though schools do mirror the communities in which they're housed, they're still more ideologically diverse than any other venue that kids are probably in. And if high-quality civic education depends on ideological diversity and other kinds of diversity as well, you know, ethnic, racial, religious, then even though schools are increasingly segregated and increasingly not as diverse as they were in the past, they still are more diverse than other places where young people are going to be. And so it's just going to be very difficult to teach people how to engage in a democratic community that's diverse if they're not learning that in a place that has at least some degree of diversity.
Yeah. You know what? I thought it was interesting in your book, you talk about how schools are becoming resegregated again. Talk to us a little bit more about that. And it's not just on racial lines, it's also on economic lines.
Right. And we should be really worried about this. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of people who are really worried about it. So I think what's happening is that our experiment with desegregation worked better in some places than it did in others, but I don't think people are as committed to it. I think the idea that you're going to get a better education if you're in a diverse community, that's an idea that a lot of us believe is true, both philosophically and empirically. But I don't think that belief is as widespread today as it might have been 30 years ago. And, you know, I think we also have segregated ourselves in terms of where we live. There's this really interesting book called The Big Sort by a journalist, Bill Bishop. And in The Big Sort, he talks about how Americans increasingly are moving to live close to people who are similar to them. So, you know, you'll have gated communities where everyone in the community is, you know, upper middle class. Or you'll have communities that are, you know, predominantly conservative. Or, you know, someone might say, well, gosh, I don't want to move to Austin, Texas, because that's a predominantly, you know, of a political shade that I don't support. And so that's a problem, because then we've got these silos of sameness, and then they produce schools that are silos of sameness. And the other problem is that even in schools where there are good measures of diversity, so you've got, you know, good ethnic diversity and racial diversity and social class diversity, if we track the curriculum and if we create, you know, honors classes and uber honors classes and remedial classes, et cetera, what happens is that we end up separating kids by race and by social class. Not always. I mean, there's some school districts that are really good at not doing this, but we know that tracking does produce certain kinds of segregation. I think that's a problem.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Diana E. Hess. We're talking about her book, The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. Now, I want to talk about the fact that you decided to study classes where there was at least 20% of engagement at a time. And you said, in truth, very little open discussion is happening in U.S. classrooms. So talk to us about that, the 20% engagement.
Right. Well, so we were in classrooms where there was lots and lots of discussion, in classrooms where there wasn't quite as much. And we separated the classes into categories based on both quantity and quality of classroom discussion. And so in those classes in which students were engaged in discussion at least 20% of the time, that caused us to say that class is what we label the best practice discussion class, as long as the quality of that discussion was good. And what was interesting to us is that, you know, 20% sounds to people like a really low bar.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually incredibly unusual. We know that most kids are in classes in which they very rarely say anything.
That's amazing.
It's really problematic because what we know about learning is that there are very few silent learners. And the notion that you can just sit there and receive information and that's learning is just totally, completely outmoded. And good teachers know that. So in the classes we were in where we thought, you know, really good learning was occurring, it in large part was because teachers were able to teach kids how to deliberate important questions in high-quality ways. It wasn't just blather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these students had to be prepared for these discussions. They came in, you know, already knowing quite a bit, and they were learning the skills of how to learn more from one another. And it wasn't that the teachers didn't have an active role in these classes. Teachers still were doing all sorts of things where they were more the center of attention. But as a general rule, what we found is that we wanted students to do the intellectual work. And in classrooms where students were simply listening to the teacher lecture, that wasn't, quite frankly, hard enough
mm-hmm.
for students to be learning what they needed to learn. So my problem with lecturing is not that it's always a problem, because I think most classes there should be some lectures and they need to be high quality. But if that's the only thing on the menu, we're not asking enough of young people for them to learn what we need them to learn.
Yeah, especially kids that age. I sort of am more familiar with the thought of a lecture in higher education, you know, colleges and so on. The focal question for the political classroom was, how should we live together? Elaborate a little bit more on that basic question and how it's navigated in schools.
Well, how should we live together really has three components. The first one is should. In other words, we believe that the powerful questions that we have to negotiate as a society are questions that have, you know, at least some normative component. And so it really is important to think about how should we do something, meaning that there's a choice there and we have to have ideas about how we make those choices. And then the second thing is we, right? So choices are not all individual, that in the best case scenario, when we're making decisions about important policy issues, we're not looking just at our own narrow interests. Not that it's wrong to stick up for your own interests, that's important, but that we also want to consider, well, what does this mean for the we?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing is that it's actually a question, and we made a distinction in the book between open questions and settled questions. And open questions are live questions for which there are multiple and competing views. They're not questions that, you know, have been settled or questions that can be answered empirically. And so we make a distinction between a question like, is climate change occurring, compared to what should we do about climate change? So in the first, is climate change occurring, we argue that that's an empirical question. And in fact, that empirical question has been answered. We know that the answer to that is yes.
Mm-hmm.
The question, what should we do about climate change, that is a question that is not settled yet, right? There's lots of live debates about that. And a controversial political issue or a question of how should we live together is one like that, where you've got an open question of policy for which we want people to consider all sorts of things, including what are the interests of others.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to tell you that one of the really intriguing schools that you talked about in this study was Adams High, where they actually simulated legislative sessions. I thought that was really fascinating because so many people, even adults, don't know what our democracy actually does and how many details it entails to get a bill through, to get a law passed. To talk to us about Adams High a little bit. I wish they did that everywhere.
Right. I love what they're doing at Adams High. And fortunately, what they're doing at Adams High is spreading to lots of other schools. So there's, I think, maybe 20 or 25 schools within 200 miles of Adams High.
And where is Adams? Can you tell people where Adams High is?
I can't tell you exactly where it is because we have to have confidentiality the study. But I can tell you that it's outside of a major city in the United States in the Midwest, and that it's a working-class community that is racially and ethnically diverse and for which there's a lot of social class diversity, too. Mm-hmm. So in this high school, Adams High, they had a lot of strengths that they could build on. You know, one strength is they had this diverse student body, and another strength is they had these teachers who were absolutely committed to creating a way for students to experience firsthand what it was like to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And so they designed over a number of years this really elaborate and high-quality simulation that's now become just an incredibly important piece of students' senior year. And they spend an entire semester doing this, and they create the bills. And the bills are always so incredibly forward-looking. Like one of the things that I'm always interested in, and every year I look at the bills that the students are deliberating, I still do, because they're always on the edge of the wave. They've come up with some idea that I think, where did they get that from? And then lo and behold, a year later, in state legislatures, I see the same thing. Not that they're causing it to happen in actual legislatures, but the young people these young people have an uncanny ability to predict what's going to be important in the future.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating the way they do that because they actually debate and they write bills and they negotiate. And, you know, it's something that really isn't happening as an example for them in our own government. So it's amazing that they're learning this.
Right, right. And when we interviewed them, they talked about how difficult it was. That most of them actually had lots of newfound respect for how hard it is to be a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
But they also recognized that what they needed to do was to have a functioning legislature, not to just have a polarized body of people shouting at one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so this represents a real tension in civic education, which is, do we want the schools to mirror what's going on in the world outside of school, or do we want the schools to actually create something that's better than what's going on in the world outside of school? And, you know, the teachers at Adams High were not interested in having students create legislatures that were highly dysfunctional. You know, they were interested in using this simulation as a tool, an intellectual tool, to help kids learn things and develop the skills they needed.
Wow, that's really amazing to me. Now, you did follow up on these kids after they left high school, right? For two years later and 4 years later?
Right.
Talk to us about some of the, you know, the comments and philosophies that you found from these experiences.
Well, it was really fun to do the follow-ups because, you know, we're always interested in teachers in the question of, well, what difference does this make anyway?
Mm.
And especially in civic education, we're interested in that because what we're trying to do in civic education is make sure that young people do participate politically and civically. So we want to know about that. And there hasn't been very much research in the past that's helped us understand it. So what did we learn? Well, one thing we learned is that in these really high-quality classes, the classes that we called best practice classes, that students looked back on what they had learned with a lot of respect and appreciation. And especially if they had gone out of their community into a place where they encountered difference that was striking. And they thought that they had been prepared for that in ways that they didn't think had happened in other classes in their school.
Mm.
So that was one thing. The other thing that was interesting is that they believed that it was important to have a political view on issues.
Mm.
Not that you had to form a political view without knowing anything, but that as citizens, to just wander around saying, well, I don't know, you know, I don't care, that is just not the way to go.
Mm.
And so, you know, kids reported being much more interested in, you know, following the news and keeping up with current events, et cetera. And we thought that was obviously quite important. You know, that being said, one of the really interesting findings and troubling findings is that kids who were raised in these like-minded communities were much more likely to participate politically as adults.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's because adults are much more likely to participate politically if they have really strong political views, and really strong political views tend to be formed in these ideologically similar communities.
Mm.
And so we've got this conundrum, because increasingly the people who participate politically are the entrenched partisans.
As we see, yeah.
Yeah, and so if those are the people who are participating politically, then the system is going to reflect that. So when people say, well, you know, what do we do about polarization, especially polarization that is, you know, really, really negative, you know, I think the first thing we have to do is look at how we're creating it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is one way that we're creating it. So it's a problem, because in a healthy political system, you've got people participating kind of across the spectrum. And you don't only have people weighing in who are the most entrenched politically, which is not to say that there's anything wrong with partisanship. I mean, I don't think you could have a democracy without partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are levels of healthy versus not very healthy, and we have certainly crossed into the not very healthy.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Now, Diana, we're almost out of time. In about 1 minute, can you give us a few conclusions? Are schools living up to their goal of helping nurture engaged citizens in our schools, do you think?
I think some schools are living up to that goal, and I think the teachers that we showcase in the political classroom are really exemplars. I mean, they are inspiring. One of the things that I came away with after working on the study for so many years and spending so many years writing the book with Paula McAvoy is that there are some really excellent teachers who we really need to learn from and emulate. That being said, the other key finding is that the public, and parents especially, and school administrators need to support teachers in this kind of work. So if we want to use schools as a place where students learn how to talk about these controversial political issues with people who have differing points of view, then when that happens in classes, we need to laud it and applaud it, not critique it. So if a young person comes home and talks about a discussion on, let's say, immigration policy, and that they heard in the classroom some views that are different from what they heard at home, that the parent should say, that's fabulous. That's exactly what public schools should do. And oftentimes, I think, we have a tendency to say, well, we want schools to mirror our own ideological views, and we shouldn't. And if we do, we're going to produce schools that are not going to produce good citizens.
Yeah, that's great. Great conclusion, Diana. Do you have any contact information in case people want to get in touch or talk to you about the book?
Sure. They could email me at dhess@wisc.edu or just Google Diana Hess or Paula McAvoy, and you'll get our contact information. Our publisher, Routledge, also has a website for the book. And Paul and I are creating our own website, which not surprisingly is going to be thepoliticalclassroom.org. And hopefully that will be up in a couple weeks.
Okay. Well, Diana Hess, thank you so much. The book, again, is called The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. Diana Hess, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.